We ain't going out like that. Watch me go and bounce right back. Cause we ain't going out like that, no. We ain't going out like that. We ain't going out like that. Watch me go and bounce right back. Hi everyone. Welcome to Syracuse Sport Business Conference's 2024 Fall Forum in partnership with David B. Falk College of Sport and Human Dynamics. Before we begin, we'd like to acknowledge with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. My name is Nathan Gross.
And I'm Jeremy Scott. We're the co-founders of the SSBC. We are a student-run organization that aims to bridge this gap between Syracuse students and opportunities across the sport industry. We're so happy to have you here at our event and hope you appreciate all that we planned. As we move along this year and grow this organization, we'll be working toward another event this coming spring. So to stay updated on our work and future programming, make sure to follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram at Syracuse SBC.
We'd like to extend a special thank you to our amazing Alumni Advisory Board and the Falk College staff for all of your support and guidance through this process. This also wouldn't be possible without the support of Dean Jordan and his belief in our vision back in the fall of 2023. Thank you all, and we are so glad to have each one of you be a part of this event. Now I'd like to introduce our moderator. Although she may be new to Falk College, to the Falk College team, she has had a storied career as the Chief Communications Officer for Syracuse Athletics. We are so happy to have Professor Sue Edson with us at Falk College and here today leading our incredible panel.
So I just got a kick out of Professor. That wasn't my title when I walked the halls of the Lally Athletics Complex. Welcome, everybody, and welcome to our panelists. The next 90 minutes with our guests promises to just be amazing. What we'll learn from them will be fantastic, and they have so much to share. But before we start, let's congratulate the leadership and members of the Syracuse Sports Business Conference. A lot of hard work and passion and effort has gone into putting this event together. And so hats off to the leaders, Nathan Gross, Jeremy Scott, and Andrew Sunder. And please join us in recognizing them. Thank you. And as you can see on the screen, the names of our guests today on the far left, we have John Duncan, the Vice President of Enforcement for the NCAA. We have Nick Carparelli, the Executive Director of Bowl Season, who I've known for a long, long time. And John Wildhack, our Athletics Director at Syracuse University and formerly of ESPN. So we're excited to hear what you all have to share. And we'll start with just an easy topic. If you wouldn't mind just explaining your job title, explaining what it means, what your title is, where you went to school, and the moment you knew that you made the right choice to work in college sports. John, we'll start with you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is John Duncan. I'm Vice President for Enforcement at the NCAA. It's very cool to be here. Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been a great event. It's been a great experience. Thank you to Dean Jordan for his friendship over the years. He also is my judge, by the way, in that context we can explain later. But my title is Vice President of Enforcement. I lead the enforcement staff at the NCAA, all divisions, all sports. Alma mater, is that what you said? William Jewell College is a Division II school outside of Kansas City. I went to law school at the University of Kansas. In the moment when I was really glad that I chose sports as a career, there's actually two. And one goes back to the introductory comments about Native American impact on our culture, and that may be a conversation for another day, but that was a poignant moment for me when the NCAA took a stand on Native American imagery and mascots in athletics. But the moment was in my prior life as a lawyer, practice law. One of our really successful, outrageously successful clients was a gentleman who told me his autobiography one time. And he was from Nowheresville, Iowa, dying little city in Iowa. And his only ticket out of that city was that he could play basketball. And if it weren't for basketball, he would still be in that dying little town in Iowa. And yet, because he could shoot a ball, he got into junior college, he then transferred to a Division II school, earned his degree, PhD, became outrageously successful, and changed the trajectory of generations of the Fisher family because of basketball. And I will never forget the import of sport in that guy's life, millions of other people.
That's awesome. Thanks, John.
I'm Nick Carparelli. I'm the executive director of Bowl Season. I'd first like to say I want to thank the Syracuse Sports Business Conference for allowing this panel discussion to double as our Bowl Season podcast. So for those people here who want to see it again, for those people who are not here, you can watch it on Any Given Season. It's the name of our podcast. We tackle a number of issues in sports, college sports specifically. And my goal in doing that was to shed a light on all the great work that's happening here at the Falk School of Sports Management, all the great work that the students do in putting this on. So hopefully we'll get a little bit more recognition for all the amazing things happening here in upstate New York. I've had a number of great jobs in sports. You know, prior to bowl season, I was in charge of sports marketing at Under Armour. I worked at the Big East Conference for 12 years. I worked for Bill Belichick in New England and got a Super Bowl ring. I was the director of football operations at Notre Dame, in charge of football recruiting. But my first job in sports was my best job in sports, and that was as a graduate assistant for the football program here at Syracuse in 1992-94, which ties into the moment I knew that I wanted a career in sports. It might have been coincidentally the same day I met Sue Edson in 1992, but that wasn't the reason. So I'm sorry. My first day on the job in 1992 was in January. I was a Syracuse fan. I watched Syracuse play. Kadri Ismail was a very dynamic player at that time. And maybe within an hour of being in the office, Kadri Ismail walks in and asks me if I could help him with something. And I said, oh, this is pretty cool. And that ties to our very first game that fall. We're at East Carolina, our first offensive play from the scrimmage. We used to have this triple option formation, which I think we invented here at Syracuse, and a lot of people copied it. Kadri was a wide receiver, motion in the backfield. We were about at the 40-yard line. Marvin Grace pitched it to him, took it to the house, and I said, this is pretty cool. I need to work in sports. And I got my MBA here. My undergrad was at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. I was a mechanical engineering degree, so my first job was designing aircraft engines at Pratt & Whitney, which might sound cool, but it did not compare to that moment that I knew that was going to have a career in sports.
Thanks, Nick. John?
Thanks, Sue. Professor Edson. Got to get used to that. John Wildhack, Director of Athletics at Syracuse University. I'm a Syracuse alum, proud alum of the Newhouse School. From the time I was a little kid, from as far back as I can remember, I've always loved sports and passionate about sports. And I've been fortunate enough to make my passion my career and my profession. And I always tell kids, if you can make your passion your profession, you're ahead of 90% of the people in the world. Because just there's not a lot of people who get to do that. And I've loved every minute I've worked in this industry. And I tell people, like, you got to be a little bit crazy to work in this industry. Because it's 7 days a week. You know, holidays. You know, you're working, right? Because there's games. There's baseball, July 4th, Memorial Day. There's, you know, five NBA games on Christmas. There's NFL games on Christmas. You got to be a little crazy to work in the industry, so I am. But I loved every minute of it. And I was talking to John earlier before we came in. I said, you need downtime this summer? He said, no. And it's just kind of the nature of the industry. And I think if you're going to be in this industry, you really need to love it. You really need to put your arms around. And if you do, it's incredibly fulfilling. I believe sport is one of the few things, unfortunately, in our society that brings people together for a communal experience. And obviously, our society, as we all know, is more polarized in so many ways than it's ever been. And I think sport, and I see it in person, what sport can do, it brings people together regardless of their background. You know, sport is diversity. In every respect of the word, and to be able to work in the industry. First, I started my career at ESPN, spent my entire career there. Told my parents I'd be there for 3 years. I lost track of time. Turned into multiples of years. I came back here 8 years ago, becoming the athletic director. Part of it is I've always stayed connected to Syracuse after graduation. I'm on the advisory board of the Falk School of Sport. And this place, Syracuse, gave me the foundation to go to have success at ESPN and come back and try to give back to some place that meant so much and did so much for me. That was really one of the driving reasons why I came back years ago.
Fantastic, thank you all. And for members of the audience, we have a few questions to get us started today with the QR code up here on the screen. If you have questions, take hit the QR code and submit your questions, and then we'll follow up our questions with all of your questions so that you can hear what you want to know. So thank you. There's so much change in college sports today. It sounds so silly to say because it's every single day. NIL, transfer portal, conference realignment, those are just today's topics, but I know there's more. So how are you and your organization adapting, and with whom are you collaborating to strategize? John, start with you.
Well, the world of college athletics is incredibly dynamic, and it is changing, on a daily basis almost. So it goes back to what I said, you can look crazy and look at this industry, right? But it's a really fluid time. In terms of, I'm going to take this in two parts. First, the ACC, and we have Stanford in tonight. It was their first ACC game, and obviously we had Stanford, Cal, and SMU last year. And Chasker and I, we were strong proponents of it because we looked at what's going on around the country, around the nation. Kind of geography and conference alignment went out the window when the Big Ten added USC and UCLA. We saw at other conferences we were doing, we thought there was some strength in numbers. You're adding three unbelievable academic institutions, I mean Stanford, Cal, and SMU. Important markets for the ACC network. To get in those markets and improve the financial performance of the ACC network. I think for us, for Syracuse too, I mean, we're a global brand. That Block S is recognized all over the world, and I can speak from personal experience because I was fortunate enough, and as an ESPN, I traveled all over. And I could be in Tokyo, and if I had something with the Block S on, inevitably someone would come running up to me and tell me about their Syracuse story. So for us, being the global brand that we are, large undergraduate student population based in Southern California, same in Northern California, growing in the Metroplex, I think it just made sense from a brand perspective. So that's one. Two, in terms of what we're doing here is, the world is, college athletics is going to change dramatically. And we've been preparing for that for months and for years. And our goal is to compete with Syracuse, to be at the very highest level, and to do so successfully. We're a respected, prominent athletics brand nationally, and we're going to keep it that way. And I want to do it in a way that's uniquely Syracuse. We are leveraging, and we will leverage, the intellectual capital in the Falk School of Sport. And I look at Dean Jordan, I look at Dave Maloney, I look at Rodney Ball, and things that we're going to do. I want us to be smarter than our peers and our competitors. I think we can do that. And you have to, one thing you have to do throughout your career is you have to embrace change. Because the one change is going to be your constant companion in life and in your career. And when it comes, you need to embrace it. Because if you don't, what I tell our staff all the time is, if we don't, we'll be an exhibit in the Smithsonian in Washington. Right? And I really don't want to be an exhibit in the Smithsonian in Washington anytime soon.
We don't want you there either. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, I think the hardest part for all of us is dealing with the unknown right now. I think all of us on stage here are leaders by nature, but it's really hard to lead when you don't know the circumstances under which you're operating. And even if you didn't know what they were today, that they're likely to be different tomorrow. I don't know how either of these guys do their jobs. And, for John, it's really hard to lead an athletic department. Winning is very hard. Graduating students is a challenge. You try to do both of those things and more. But the goalposts keep moving on John, between conference realignment and payment to players through either NIL or the direct payments to the house settlement, which is not settled. I don't know how you do your job. John, I don't know how you do your job. Every time somebody breaks a rule and you call them on it, they sue you. So, hopefully you can speak to that a little bit. But it's a crazy world right now. I you know, at, from a bull perspective, you know, we're forced again, I like to think I'm a leader by nature, but we're kind of forced to sit back and wait and see what unfolds with all these moving parts. We take the 43 executive directors of the 43 bowl games across the country, really take the lead from the conference commissioners and the institutions. What do you want that experience to look like for your student athletes? And as we move forward, it's going to be what do you want the payouts from the bowls to look like, right? We look forward to a day where maybe part of the $2 million per team on average that bowls pay out, does it continue to go to the institution or does it go to the student athletes or some division of that? I think that's likely to be something that's considered. But we're in the bowl season, we're just working hard to create great opportunities for student athletes and fans and communities across the country. I can't wait to see what bowl game Syracuse ends up in this year, because they will be in one.
Ditto on that one. John.
Yeah, let me start by coming back to the introduction. Everybody here has a Syracuse connection. I didn't share mine. I do as well. I didn't go to school here, but I did live here for 2 years in the 90s, 95, 96. Love Syracuse, love Central New York, love the institution. Had a great experience there. My claim to fame, which we can talk about later, if you'd like, is that every day I was here in the 90s, I committed a felony. And I say that with all the cameras running. The statute of limitations is run. I was acquitted. It's all good. The change in college sports, I think the question was collaboration. How do you collaborate? Kind of like John answered in two parts. There's kind of the micro, the enforcement-centric piece, and then there's the broader association-wide piece. And enforcement, we're viewed incorrectly, I would argue, as the bad guys, the tough guys, the heavies, the 8,000-pound gorilla, the police, and all of those negative association regulatory terms. And the dirty little secret is that we've got a better relationship. We enforcement have a better relationship with our member institutions than most people believe. We can normally begin, investigate, charge, and ultimately resolve a case and have a good relationship with the school and our conference. And it's not unusual, especially in these times, to have conversations with all of those folks in the middle of a case. What's best for the association here? What's best for the school? What's best for the national office? What's best for the association? How are we going to thread this needle? And so we collaborated at that level on a very micro perspective. Association-wide, echo what all has been said already, but on any given day, that's the NCAA headquarters. We are collaborating with any willing partner out there. Institutions, conferences, bowl season, federally elected officials, state elected officials, lawyers, our own, those who are suing us, judges, lobbyists, and any number of other different people who are trying to put a finer point on the precise questions that need to be answered and a workable solution moving forward. That's been tough to find so far. We're right in the middle of all those conversations.
Great, thank you. Thank you. With all the talk of revenue in sports, particularly college sports, there's so much focus on it today. How do you find a balance of the revenue generation, but also maintaining integrity of college sports? Because they don't seem to go hand in hand. So how do you achieve both of these goals? And Nick was here in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think the answer is simple. You have to have a willingness and a desire for that to be the case. You know, I think that's a conscious decision that we all make as part of every decision that comes our way. You know, how do you want to handle it? Do you need an extra dollar? You know, if you're going to sacrifice a lot of other things, I look at conference realignment, and I'm not going to call out any institutions, but I think they're chasing the wrong things. You know, I have yet to see a program win consistently simply because they make the most money. Otherwise, University of Texas would win every national championship. You know, I think it comes down to people. And I will, you know, John and I have had this conversation with both Syracuse alums. We're both passionate about this university. We both believe that Syracuse can't compete at the highest level. The goal is not to make the most money. The goal is to create the best experience for the student athletes, for the general student body, for the alumni of the university and community, to make them all proud and to win. And I don't think you need the most amount of money to win. You need the best people. Syracuse has been most successful has been because they've had the best people.
Yeah, I don't always believe that revenue and integrity are incompatible or mutually exclusive, but they do go together a lot with institutions, entities, individuals. Sometimes when there is more income, there is more revenue, the stakes are higher, compromise follows. It doesn't have to be inevitable, but it certainly happens. And I agree with Nick. I think the way to prevent that from happening is for the NCAA, and let me define that term. By the NCAA, I mean the colleges and universities that are the association, like Syracuse, not the humble staff in Indianapolis working at the headquarters, but the association, the schools, stick to their principles and their goals and their vision of educating students, putting on high quality athletic events between eligible student athletes, and bringing up the next generation of leaders in college sports. That's what I'm looking at here. And if we stay true, we, the association, I think we can navigate all the revenue that's pouring in. If we can't, then it's going to look different and it's not going to look better.
And John, how do you manage that from the athletic director's chair?
Well, I think number one is we're responsible. We've got about 550 student athletes, so we want to provide them the best experience possible. And all the talk about revenue generation, revenue sharing, is primarily around two sports, football, basketball. And we've got 18 other sports. And we can't forget those student athletes. We go to them and provide them the best experience possible. And you know, I think in a lot of ways we're doing that. Our graduation success rate in athletics is 94%, top five in the country. We're right there with Stanford, Duke, Notre Dame today. You know, average GPA in the spring of 2024 was a 3.3. Over 50% of our student athletes in 3.5 or more GPA. Kids are, you know, really challenging curriculum. So there's a lot of really good things that our student athletes are doing and services we're providing them. And comprehensive services, right? You know, in terms of your career development, student athlete engagement, internship opportunities, mental health, career development, how to write a resume, how to prepare for interviews. You know, we do so much, and so we have a pretty good understanding and background in that. And none of that gets reported, and that's okay. I don't expect it to, but we do it, and we're committed to do it. So it starts with your values. So if the values is, I tell, when parents are recruited, ask me, like, what do? I give them a really simple answer. I say, we're in the business of developing young people. And if your son or your daughter comes to Syracuse, we want them to fulfill their full potential academically and athletically. And then when they leave here, they're prepared to have success, no matter what's next for them. And that includes somebody who's good enough to play professionally. We need to get them ready, because our world's going to change dramatically in that respect. In terms of revenue generation, every single AD in the country goes to bed at night thinking about revenue generation, and the first thing when they wake up in the morning, they think about revenue generation. And if any of them tell you anything different, call them out. That's just the reality of it. Because we have to generate the revenue to be competitive. Do we need the most? No, we don't need the most. Nick's right. Any great organization, it starts and defined by its people. I think we've got really great people at Syracuse Athletics. I think we have a really good group of coaches. But we have to generate revenue for them to be competitive. Because if we're not in that respect, as good as they are, we won't be successful. And they won't stay. It's as simple as that.
And part of the growth of college athletics is this new 12-team college football playoff, and it impacts each of you differently in your roles. And we'll start with John. How does it impact how you manage the Syracuse football program, and how do you think it impacts the college football landscape?
It doesn't impact how we look at football or how we run our football operation. I think it's really good for the sport. Because go back and study the history of the 14 playoff. You know, it was basically who's in it every year, right? Ohio State, it's Clemson, it's Alabama, it's Georgia. A really small select number of schools, just to be candid. You know, the 130 schools that play FBS football, you know, there's maybe 15 that realistically every year had a shot at making the playoff. Every once you get an outlier like TCU a couple years ago. When it goes to 12, that opens doors for everyone. That opened doors for us. You know, it's realistic for us to be a top 12 team and a top 12 program. We can do that. So I think it's really good from that perspective. I think it will generate greater interest in the sport. I know some people said, well, the games in November aren't going to mean as much. Yes, they will. Because more teams are going to be in the hunt for a playoff and have the opportunity for a playoff. And even if Ohio State and Michigan are guaranteed to be in the playoff, it's not going to diminish the rivalry with that game. Do you think Alabama-Auburn's going to get less intense? Hell no. You know, they hate each other. 365 days a year, and they'll continue to do so. So I think it'll help grow the overall health of the sport. I think it'll increase fan avidity. It'll grow the fan base. And the other thing, independent of what Sue asked, the other thing that's going to grow the fan base is the EA game. Huge. Huge. Because you know who that's going to get? That's going to get you. Go back to the Madden game, what it did for the NFL. EA college football could do the same for college football, in my opinion.
So. And John, going to you from the national office, what's the perception and perspective of the 12-team playoff, and how has it impacted what happens in Indianapolis?
Yeah, I agree with what John said, especially the EA part. That's big. And this is one where I'm going to not answer on behalf of the whole national office, because I can't speak for the other departments there, but I can tell you what it means for enforcement. And it's really not the expansion of the CFP, it's just postseason opportunities generally. There is revenue associated with that. There are also other benefits associated with those postseason games, additional contests, additional practice opportunities. And what it means for us in enforcement is that if we're doing business with a school, any school, CFP, full season, any sport, who has a reasonable chance of making a postseason opportunity, it affects the degree to which some of those schools resist consequences. And it's not about the merits of sometimes whether the underlying violation happened or not. It's about the revenue associated with and the other opportunities associated with postseason competition. And we see sometimes that schools dig in cases where they wouldn't otherwise to protect that postseason opportunity, which I totally understand. And we work with schools to try to be flexible around that. So I wouldn't say that the expansion of the CFP directly impacts enforcement dramatically, but we're very mindful of impact of postseason opportunities on student athletes and the programs that they play for.
Thank you for that. Nick, you're in a unique seat because of bowl season and the college football playoff. To me, they go hand in hand, but give us the real story.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with what John Wildhack said. Yeah, I am a big college football fan. It's not just my job. And I'm excited to see the 12-team playoff. I think a lot of people are surprised to hear me say that. In fact, when I get interviewed, people ask me a question about the impact the playoffs going to have on the bowls, and then their eyes are like, gotcha on this one. But I love the answering to that question because it's the CFP and bowl season go hand in hand. Together they make up college football's bowl season. You can't have one or the other, right? You need both. The CFP, we need a great mechanism in this great sport to crown a national champion. But at the same time, to John Duncan's point, college, NCAA, and college administrators across the country feel that we're at a point where we need more postseason opportunities for student athletes, not less. So college football is unique. It's a 12-team playoff now. Might it go to 16 someday? I think I would have to say yes. Would it go beyond that and a team has to play 5 games in the postseason? I would say probably not, right? So whether it's 12 or 16 postseason opportunities, that's not enough for 135 FBS institutions, and that's where bowl season. And so what bowl season has had for over 100 years. You know, I think sometimes when something's been around for a long time, you tend to take it for granted. Bowl games have been around for 100 years, you know, but if they didn't exist, and I came to the leaders that be with a plan, and I said, I got an idea. After the 12 teams are seeded in the playoff, every other team that's 500 or better will earn the right to play one more game. They'll play against a team they wouldn't normally schedule. They'll play in a location or destination that would normally go, and it will give fans in 40 communities across the country an opportunity to see a level of football that they wouldn't otherwise. NYC. And it'll help grow the sport, it'll help expose it in unique ways, and keep this great sport as healthy as it is. I think people say, wow, what a great idea, but how would we ever execute that? The Bowl system's been doing that for almost 100 years, and we're going to continue to do that.
And that leads me then to the next question, Nick. The college football playoff expansion has been talked about for years. So from your seat, how have you been managing that and working with your organization and the conference commissioners and everybody to get to where you are today?
So a big part of my job is to be the spokesperson for the Bowl system as a whole. You know, 40-plus executive directors. They own and operate and manage their own game, and they do a great job of building their brand and their community. They oversee the system. And part of that is to network with all 10 conference commissioners, people at the NCAA office. I often present, I present it every year at the football competition committee meetings at the NCAA office. I go to the ACC meetings every year, and I end up hanging out with John most of the time. I probably should be spreading it around a little bit, but you hang out with your friends. And so I'm constantly talking to those people about postseason college football, the impact the playoff has had. The 14 playoff has been around for 10 years now, so let's not forget that the bowl system has adjusted. You know, the move from 4 to 12 is minimally impactful relative to what happened 10 years ago. And I'm always asking the question of athletic directors and coaches, is the bowl system still meaningful? Do you want to go to bowl games? And it's a resounding yes. Some of them look at me like I have three heads, like what am I even asking? Because there's, you know, John mentioned in the old 4-team playoff, you know, maybe there's 15 teams that are vying for those spots. In the 12-team playoff, maybe it's 30 towards the end of the year. I'm making that up, but whatever it is, there are a lot of programs that aren't equipped to be vying for one of those 12 playoff spots on an annual basis, right? So what are they playing for? What's their reward at the end of the season, right? They all have the opportunity to get there. But just because a team doesn't get there doesn't mean that their season has not been a success, right? So we need rewards and memorable experiences for student athletes of all levels of Division I, and that's what we do.
I think just real quick to add on to what Nick said, two things, is the experience when you go to a bowl game. You know, we were in New York 2 years ago for the Pinstripe, and just the experience that our athletes got, right? You know, we went to the 9/11 Memorial, you know, incredibly moving. We didn't see music hall. I mean, a bunch of us went to the New York Stock Exchange, got to hear the opening bell. I mean, experiences you get are, you know, they stay with you, they stay with the student athletes, you know, the rest of their lives. The other thing about the 14 playoff, if you look at viewership over the 10-year cycle of the 14 playoff, viewership didn't increase. It actually declined from the first year. And it's one of the very few postseasons, baseball being the other one, where viewership in the postseason has declined. So again, I think 12-team, could you imagine if we made the playoff and we hosted a first-round game on this campus? This place in this community would be upside down. It'd be great. It'd be fantastic. So, you know, 12 is the right way to go, and you can still do it and preserve what Nick has worked so hard and done a great job with, is the remainder of the bowls to make sure as many teams as possible get that experience in the postseason.
I, for one, am into turning this town upside down, so let's do that.
Amen.
Changing the direction a little bit, John Duncan, talking about student athletes, NIL is such a topic today. What are the challenges that you and your staff face, and then how are you working with campuses in that space?
I can't really think of any. That's just a little regulatory humor. Yeah, there are many. The two that come to mind top are legal and representation, and the legal challenges are well documented. And John Montag mentioned a little while ago that you try to enforce a rule and the school doesn't like it, then they find a lawyer or government who will take up the cause and shut it down. So there are certainly legal challenges. Again, we need to institutional accountability, which is what enforcement does, by the way. I always want to be very clear, enforcement, our shop, is focused on institutional, grown-up, adult accountability.
not student athletes, not eligibility. If you're dealing with a student athlete, you're normally giving that student athlete immunity, giving him or her his their eligibility back in exchange for information about adults' institutional culpability. But even in the institutional culpability, there is legal risk for student with lawsuits filed across the country. The other is just reputational risk, and that is our world is looking out for opportunities for student athletes across the board, and the NCAA supports that, and our institutions support that, we support that. But there is a tension between regulating that environment and providing opportunities, and so there are misperceptions about our efforts. And so there is a reputational risk as well. We try to navigate that as best we can by being good partners with schools, trying to show our support for student athletes who are earning NIL, trying to exercise our common sense when opening investigations, managing the scope of those investigations, and certainly resolving a case, and making sure that we're part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Thank you. We have one more question for John Wildhack, and then we'll turn to your questions. So again, please use the QR code to submit your questions. Now that you've heard a little bit about what's been said, what other questions have come to mind, please use the QR code to engage. And John, the question for you is, obviously with Florida State and Clemson, all the talk around the grant of rights. You have a great knowledge of that from your work at ESPN and now at Syracuse. Maybe you can help everybody understand that a little bit more and how it impacts the schools, ESPN, and the whole
thing. Sure, so basically what the grant of rights really is to simplify this, is the schools assign their media rights to the conference. And the conference then negotiates on behalf of their member institutions with the media companies. So whether it's CBS, Fox, NBC, Warner Brothers Discovery, ESPN, Amazon Prime, whoever. In the grant of rights, the first conference to do this was the Big Ten, probably about 20 years ago. Jim Delaney was the commissioner, and Jim and I are really good friends. We sat across the negotiating table multiple occasions in our career, and we negotiated like hell against each other, but formed an incredible friendship through that. And Jim came to me and he said, I want to do a groundbreaking deal for the Big Ten. And I'm like, all right, I'm open to it. And he said, one of the things we've done is we have secured an assignment of the media rights of our schools for a 10-year period, so I can guarantee to you, ESPN, ABC, Disney, these schools are going to be with us. And when you're a buyer of those media rights, which I was to ESPN, you want to know what you're buying, pure and simple. So that's the origin of it about 20 years ago. Every Power Four conference has something like that. That's why UCLA and USC wait until this year, because they had to wait for the grant of rights to expire in the Pac-12. Texas and Oklahoma negotiated their way out of the year early from the Big 12 to get to the SEC. So every school in the ACC is signed the grant of rights. 3 years ago, we went down to Greensboro. Every school, you brought your general counsel, whoever you wanted, and you know what? You looked at the base rights media contract, the ACC network, and the grant rights. And it's, you know, it's clear as day. And you know, it's ironclad to so far. It's obviously been challenged by Clemson and Florida State. And the thing is I think the ACC is on incredible legal ground. I know it from both sides, but I know it from being in Syracuse. Ironically, the last deal I did at ESPN was the ACC. 3 months later, so I have knowledge on both sides of it. But if for some reason the grant of rights did not hold with the ACC, it's not going to hold with the SEC, it's not going to hold with the Big 12, right? It's not going to hold with the Big 10, and then you are going to have, you will have change, which will be incredibly, incredibly dramatic, because at that point, it becomes free for all.
Thank you, John. You ready for some questions from the audience?
Thank you. name's Andrew. Thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. And thank you to everybody who submitted questions. And let's dive right into it. All right, first off, how are all of you dealing with sports betting, and how much is it growing within college sports? And what are the challenges with it?
Well, I'll take that initially. We do a lot of education with our student athletes. It's there, and anybody who doesn't think it's, you know, it doesn't exist is crazy, right? And what I worry about is unscrupulous people trying to get to our athletes, right? And what really worries me is prop bets, right? That's what really worries me. We've got the ACC with U.S. Integrity. We did a deal with them this past year where they monitor every single game that has a line. And if they see something, that's inordinate, they will notify the conference, or the conference will notify the institutions. We were a leader in being an advocate for that deal. So we do education through compliance. We work directly through the ACC. It's something you, again, you worry about. You've seen issues, right? You saw it with Iowa. You saw it with Iowa State. You saw it with the Alabama baseball coach, right? So it's sports betting. It's legal in almost half the states. It will continue to grow in the number of states that it's legal. So we've got to monitor, to educate, and to watch, and to preserve the integrity of the games. And it's quite interesting because people think, the image of Las Vegas is, the back room, smoke-filled room, et cetera, that type of thing. The sophistication that the sports books have is unbelievable because they actually, they also want the integrity of the competition preserved as well. So it's a far more sophisticated industry than I think most people think. And I'd be interested in John's thought. He's probably a hell of a lot smarter than I am.
I'm not that, but we do have a lot of experience in this. So this sports betting is the subject of days-long conferences around the world, literally. And so we'll barely be able to scratch the surface here, but everything John said is correct. We boil the harms down to two of sports betting. Student-athlete well-being, and integrity of the contest. And we work really hard to partner with everybody that we can find to partner with. All the groups that I mentioned earlier, plus law enforcement, worldwide bodies that are dedicated to integrity in sport, watchdogs, integrity services, all manner of different groups to try and do both of those things. Protect student-athlete well-being, and it gets compromised a couple of ways. Student-athlete betting itself is a problem. And then student athletes who are subject to abuse or harassment or worse based on their performance when it disappoints a drunken bettor in the middle of the night. And I won't bother you with the horror stories that we see and hear and read about, but they are tragic. It is awful. So student athlete well-being and then also the integrity of the game. I agree with John on prop bets. That's why you've seen the national office working really hard with state legislatures to try to get protection for student athletes there, education, all the resources we can do to try and nip it in the bud if possible, and get people help who need it. I think your question, Andrew, was, is the problem, is it growing? Yes, and yes. And just bring it home, there's a lot of people in this room right now betting on sports. And for many of you, it's legal if you're a student athlete or in any way associated with the university, athletics department. It's a violation for you and for the school. I don't take any pleasure in saying that, but we would always rather, in enforcement, we would always rather prevent a violation than process one. So if I could point you to some resources, we've retired the old don't bet on it moniker that you may have seen over the years and replaced it with draw the line. And so I direct you to the website there. There's all manner of resources and help there that I think would be really helpful for you. Draw the line.
I cannot do any better than those two answers, so let's entertain another question.
Awesome, thank you. This next one, this is for Mr. Duncan, and it's, what are the challenges of working in enforcement when the college sports landscape can feel like the wild, wild west sometimes?
Yeah, again, I can't really think of any. So,
you know, there are many challenges. We've talked about reputational harm, we've talked about litigation risk. There's another phenomenon going on in the world that's not unique to college sports, and that is a general aversion to consequences and a general distaste for accountability. It's not a political statement, it's not a partisan statement, it's just true. And so we see that in the infractions process. The vast majority of our cases go swimmingly. And by that I mean the school self-reports, we have a cooperative, collaborative investigation, we agree on allegations, we agree on penalties, we submit those to our court, our adjudicative body, which is populated by Dean Jordan and other colleagues like him, presidents, ADs, commissioners, former coaches, faculty athletics representatives, senior women administrators. And the majority of cases go just fine. But we are seeing a reluctance now for schools to self-report violations or to agree to consequences because, to a question almost an hour ago, the stakes are so high given the revenue. The other challenge that we're seeing, and I'll end with this one, is a resistance or a reluctance for individuals who have knowledge of violations about others to report them to us. Either because they have unclean hands themselves, and if we start sniffing around, we might find something on their campus, or they don't want to throw a former colleague or a potential future colleague under the bus. And so they complain about the Wild Wild West out of one side of their mouth and refuse to cooperate out of the other, which is very frustrating. And so our pledge to those folks is, rather than telling the media, rather than talking about how ineffective enforcement is, let us help you. We will protect your identity, get us the information in as much detail and as many particulars as possible, and we'll process it, and we'll try and slow traffic down for a little while, but if you can't help us, then I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Awesome, thank you. This next question is for Mr. Carparelli, and it is, as star players continue to opt out of bowl games, how can you strategize to keep bowl games interesting and around?
Not a surprising question. Get that one often. You know, opt-outs are troubling to me in a lot of ways. I think it's a symptom of too many people influencing the decision of student athletes that are not operating in their best interest. I have a lot of friends of my age that played college sports and they would give anything to play in one more game. And I think there's going to be a lot of regret, a lot of resentment on behalf of these student athletes who opt out of the bowl game 10 years, 20 years down the road, especially for those that don't play in the NFL, which is the majority of them. I think it's a problem that's beyond just bowl games. The problem is not the opt-outs by themselves, but it's a combination of the transfer portal opening up and the advent of NIL at the same time. It's the combination of those two that created a perfect storm, if you will. I'm looking forward to the days, and we talked about this at the onset. We don't know the ground rules we're operating under. They're hard to understand today. We know they're going to change in the future, but once they are settled, I'm a big believer that there's two sides to an equation. There's obligations on both ends. So while I support the notion that student athletes should get paid, I get paid, but I need to do my job in order to receive compensation, and so does everybody else on this stage. So. At some point, if a student athlete is being compensated, and we won't get into NIL for NIL's sake versus pay for play, but you need to play. If you're a football player, you're getting compensated. You need to play in 12 regular season games and a bowl game and go to the playoff. That's your obligation. If you don't do that, you don't get paid. So I think we will get to that point. I think that'll help solve the problem. But in the meantime, I'm hopeful that people will understand that the opportunity to play college sports is a privilege. Every opportunity is meaningful. I don't know why anybody would pass that up, and I'm hopeful that that problem resolves itself over time.
Awesome, thank you. This next question is for Mr. Rothack, and it is, how does Syracuse become one of the bigger university players in the NIL space or be able to compete with those schools as we move into the future? Example, Oregon, Texas or Ohio State? If so, what would be the 5+ year plan to gain that status?
The five?
5+ year plan.
No, I don't look at it 5+. I mean, candidly, in my opinion, I think within 3 years it's going to be dramatic change. So, I told our chancellor and told our board that. I don't know what that change is going to be, but I think it's going to be dramatic. So I look at a shorter horizon. I mean, for us, we need to be competitive. And again, it doesn't mean you need your, there needs to be a race to, okay, if the revenue share, the house case gets approved, $20 million is about the max cap. There's going to be schools that race to that, right? To me, it's what you do with your NIL. You've got to be competitive. So we're going to need donors. We're going to need corporate support. And I've been very vocal. Can't be done on the backs of donors. It has to be corporate support. I think NIL will come in house if the house case gets settled. In some ways, I think it'll make it easier for donors to, they're used to donating to the university. We've got 3 NIL entities. You know, they're still like, well, what is this, you know, SU football and Allen Orange United or athletes who care. So in some ways, I think it can make it a little bit easier. We're going to need corporate support. And again, we need to be smarter. We hired a GM at men's basketball. We have an analytics data expert in men's basketball because we need to be smarter. We have a GM in football. We've got a player personnel staff in football. So player evaluation in every respect, just not can a kid play. What type of kid is this? Is this kid going to go to class? Good teammate? Show up at practice? Good in the locker room? You've got to really be incredibly sophisticated in your evaluation in football and men's and women's basketball if you bring in. And candidly, it's like a pro model. And if anybody says anything different, again, call them out, because that's what it is. So we have to be competitive. If we're not competitive, Kyle McCord's not wearing number 6 for Syracuse today with NIL. And he could have gone other places for a lot more money. And I had a really close friend at school call me, Dave Howe, committed here, called me up really busting my chops on it. You know, Fadil Diggs, if we weren't competitive, wouldn't be here. And there were schools that tried to poach him in the spring. The other is culture and relationships. The culture of a team and the relationships with coaches really, really matter. You know, Kyle McCord's had a relationship with Fran Brown since he was playing Little League football outside of Philadelphia. They knew each other. Kyle Nuncio Campanelle, our quarterback coach. Fadil Diggs is from Camden, where Elijah Robinson's from. Fadil was a Texas A&M and 2-time captain. Elijah was a defensive coordinator there. So relationships are critically important because, and I've said this to all 3 of our coaches, you've got to minimize your misses in this world. You have to minimize your misses. And yep, okay, everybody wants, you know, this 5-star that's in the portal, why are they in the portal? Why? Okay, why? Dig. Get the information. Maybe that person's not the right fit here. Or maybe somebody who's really good, not quote the 5-star, but it's a better fit. It could be a better teammate, maybe a really good player for Syracuse. So we've got to be smarter.
Thanks for listening to this very special episode of the Any Given Season podcast. A big thanks to all the students in the Fox School of Sports Management at Syracuse University for hosting an amazing event. I would also like to thank Syracuse University Director of Athletics, John Wildhack, the NCAA's VP of Enforcement, John Duncan, and Sue Edson from the Fox School for participating in this discussion and offering their insights into the changing landscape of college athletics. You can catch all past and future episodes of Any Given Season on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. And for all the up-to-date bowl season news, please go to our website, bowlseason.com, or social media at Bowl Season. Thanks for joining.
Yeah. It's been a long time coming. It's been a